Hey folks, Jeff here, and it is April something, Friday afternoon, beautiful day in Boulder, and I'm here with a dear old friend and colleague, Rob McNamara, who has just finished his second book called The Elegant Self. And the subhead, Rob, is?
It's a radical approach to personal evolution for greater influence in life.
Yeah. And I love that. And I love the elegant self, just the idea of marking these higher levels of development and functioning with the term elegance. And that's so appropriate to you because of your physicality and your first book was...
Strength to Awaken.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's sort of a natural for you. So maybe just first of all, let's start there. Why the elegant self, or why'd you use that terminology? Yeah.
Well, you know, I'm completely obsessed with development. You know, I love studying it so much. And in particular, integral consciousness as a label for a particular altitude, as Ken would say, it's captivated my attention for, you know, 25 years or something crazy like that. Mm-hmm. I've been studying it since I came across this, and I've been really interested in our highest levels of complexity, and that's kind of why I went to Naropa to study transpersonal psychology and study these highest bands of maturity that we know of, at least. But, you know, we've been in this, you know, the integral scene, we've been in it for a long time, like in the trenches, trying to communicate it. And when I say integral consciousness to you, we're on the same page, but for the broader audience, it means nothing. That means nothing. But the term elegant, like, do you want to be elegant in relationship? Do you want to be elegant in the boardroom? Elegance, it's a gorgeous word. Mm-hmm. It really wasn't even my idea. More like the idea captivated me and just grabbed Rob and was like, that's what we should be calling integral consciousness is mm-hmm. something like elegance. Mm-hmm. So the elegant self is really like in a rigorous developmental injection of integral consciousness mm-hmm. into the world. And so I'm really excited because people are attracted. It just the simplicity and ingenuity of elegance, what it represents in the conventional culture, it actually, I think, is pointing towards our greater developmental capacities as human beings.
So yeah, I think so too. Yeah. And when I think of elegance, I think of somebody who's elegant, is beautiful, they're appropriate, they're receptive, they move well in the space.
Right, right.
They're lovely to be around. They have a certain intelligence. There's a goodness. I mean, I think these are all good words for these higher stages of development too, right?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So Rob, you use Keegan and Suzanne Cook-Reuter's model more than Ken's altitudes.
Right.
And you work with those in the book. And the three that you work with are what we would call the socialized mind,
yep.
the self-authoring mind, and the self-transforming mind.
Right.
So just to lay those three markers down for our listeners, could you just give us a, you know, headline and first paragraph for each of those?
Yeah, totally. So I would say that the socialized mind is most simply the mutuality and loyalty that we have to our community, to our family, to our the institutions that we belong to. And
we try to be good people.
Yeah. This is kind of the conventional stage of development. Like we need to outgrow our self-centered kind of adolescence and actually just belong and have a loyalty. So that would be kind of the socialized mind. The self-authoring mind is at its heart, I have some intelligence that's fallible inside of me, but it's way more trustable than any authority in the world.
Hmm. Right. Wow.
And
so I trust myself, my own instincts, or not even instincts, but my own conclusions or my own values would trump what I get from the outside.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Yeah. And why Keegan calls this the self-authoring is it's something that you invest time and energy to construct it. You're the author. You're writing what are the values that matter most, and they actually guide and direct me. But I have this inner compass that directs me in the world. And this resolves the, you know, when we're in the socialized mind, it's like I'm talking to you right now. And so there's a loyalty here, mm-hmm. right? But if there's a conflicting agenda with another friend, you know, and they actually happen to be across town, I'll actually just act out the loyalty that's most close to me. So emotional proximity and physical proximity determines which loyalty I'll act out. And so you can just see the limitation. It becomes incredibly challenging because you're dating somebody and your friend has a different perspective on them, but the other friend really likes them. And when you're with the partner, you're totally loyal to them. And, you know, but when you're at work, there's different competing loyalties there in terms of which boss, you know, which, yeah. So we get pulled in all these different directions and the self-authoring mind brings resolution. It's like, actually, I need some higher intelligence, some deeper perception into life that enables me to negotiate what should I actually do, mm-hmm. you know? And so this inner authority inside of me it's kind of the heart of the self-authoring mm-hmm. mind.
Okay. So maybe we'd say something like the socialized mind is wants to be pleasing and wants to fit in to the situation they're at.
Totally.
And it can change from situation to situation.
Yep.
And then the self-authoring mind, there's a nexus of authority that has come online that transcends those. So no matter who I'm with or what I'm doing, there's a Jeffness
right.
that is pretty constant.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, so yeah. then we move from then socialized to self-authoring to self-transforming.
Right.
And what's that like?
Yeah, well, and this is really what the whole first part of my book investigates, is this transformation from self-authoring into the self-transforming mind, or what Keegan calls the fourth order into the fifth order. And here we outgrow autonomy, because the fourth order self-authoring that we just talked about, that's the home base. It's like a very refined and polished and integrous autonomy. But it's incredibly limited, right? To be held captive by my own agenda, no matter how well thought out and no matter how nuanced it is and how considerate, and it might even be incredibly world-centric, you know, in its orientation, and it might be deeply good, but to be held captive by my private agenda actually erases tremendous complexity in the world. It actually dulls our senses to the vividness of the trees outside your window. It actually dulls our senses to who we're actually interacting with. And so this, when we start moving into the self-transforming mind, we find a subjectivity that's what I would call interpenetrable or interpenetrating, which means that I'm not just Rob in my distinct autonomy. I still have my history and I know myself deeply well, and I have my rigorous, refined autonomy, but the novelty that's present at this stage is I'm willing to be co-created by the immediacy of this exchange that's happening right now. Mm. And all of a sudden, just the lights and the subtle nuances of the moment start to get more vivid, and we become more permeable to life around us. Mm-hmm. And this has dramatic reorientations on leadership and intimacy and attunement with life. And it's the first time probably that we can participate in a life that doesn't belong to us. Mm. You can actually start to be lived by a preciousness that doesn't belong to your autonomy. Mm-hmm. And you can watch your autonomy try and grasp at it. But you can start to participate with this novel ingredient. And there's a quality of worship. Mm-hmm. You know, and not to some transcendent other, but actually like the novelty that's emerging right now.
Right.
And one of the reasons why Keegan calls it the self-transforming mind is that literally from moment to moment to moment, I'm willing to be discovered. and co-created and transformed by the exchange.
You know?
And that's like an entirely different, rich depth of life. And like when you're talking about elegance, you're describing somebody who moves with like an ease and a beauty, and they're responsive. And the way that they interact is, it's appropriate. It's just right, you know? And it can be incredibly fierce or incredibly like warm and welcoming. And it can, like, it's diverse and flexible.
Yeah.
And that this is born only from this, you know, elegant, interpenetrating subjectivity that isn't encapsulated by, you know, Rob's agenda or Jeff's agenda.
Yeah. Yeah, I was talking to Keith Witt. There's actually a conversation on this blog.
Yeah.
Psychotherapist. And he talks about when one of his principles of psychotherapy is that, of course, he's there to influence his clients.
Right.
But he's also there to be influenced by them.
Right.
And that's one of his real tricks or secrets.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that was really profound. And that's what you're talking about, is that we would go into a situation not only with our agenda, but
right.
with the agenda of being changed
right.
or being moved by the other person.
Right.
But that's kind of scary in a way, isn't it?
Totally.
Yeah. I mean, it's certainly, I think it's pretty rare.
It is.
Actually.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have any sense of the percentages of adults at these stages of development?
Yeah. Yeah. I kind of obsess at studying them.
What do you
say? So Keegan's research shows that less than 1% of the adult population reaches fifth order in
really?
A stable way.
Which is the self-transforming.
Yes.
Now, would this be correlated to maybe second tier in Ken and spiral dynamics?
I would say that, and this is the interesting thing, when we pick up integral discourse and integral consciousness and the integral movement, there is a tremendous amount of people that are firmly rooted in fourth order or bridging between fourth and five. And in Keegan's research, there's about 6 to 7% of the population that are bridging from this self-authoring, and they're on their way into the self-transforming. They haven't quite made it yet.
Mm-hmm.
But if we add it all up, that's 7 to 8% of the adult population, which is pretty exciting.
In some flux between self-authoring and self-transforming, maybe 1% stably at self-transforming.
Yeah.
And then what did you say the percentage was of self-authoring more stably?
Self-authoring, it's usually somewhere like 35%.
Yeah. And then the rest are socialized.
Bridging between third order and fourth order.
Yeah.
So they're kind of got one foot in the socialized and one foot in the self-authoring mind. That, I believe, is somewhere in the 40% range. And then just firmly third order, we've got like, I think it's 25 or 30%, yeah. Something like that.
Well, I often think of when you ask Ken Wilber what actually aids in development, particularly this move from first to second tier, he'll often say meditation. And
yes.
And I can see why, because meditation is about observing your thoughts and just observing basically yourself as
right.
it's arising moment by moment.
Yeah.
And as you do that, you sort of get unstuck or disidentified. And you begin to be identified not with the components of self, but with the space within which those components are arising, kind of under their own power. That's the strange and, you know, weird
yeah.
thing. It's like, oh my God,
right.
you know, this Jeff thing is happening under its own power.
Yeah, and you,
and you know, what am I at this point?
Right.
And that, but there's such a relief to that, right? I mean, because you realize that literally, in a very real sense, I am being lived.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's not, and there's the part of it that is a relief is I actually don't have to fix this. I don't have to fix that. I'm not so responsible as I thought.
Yeah.
I'm not so much to blame
right.
as I thought.
Yeah.
And I love actually one of the stories you tell in your book. And I would assume this is one of your sort of principles. You're a psychotherapist yourself.
Yeah.
And that you were talking about this one girl who came in. And she had her stories about her boyfriend and, you know, how she, the problems they were having. And it was basically a problem of growth and development that she saw as pathological.
Yeah.
And isn't that just the way of things? Isn't that we think that, that we've done something wrong, and actually we're just growing.
Right, right.
So,
yeah, and this is, you know, and without a developmental orientation that's integrative, that's similar to Wilbur's model or similar to some eclectic integrative framework that makes sense of things, we have huge problems in the making. And this is just one example. There are tons of therapists, tons of professional coaches, executive coaches, performance coaching that are ideologically governed by one stage of development, which means, and if it's a pre-integral stage, it will demonize and pathologize the prior stage.
Right.
And that's running rampant in the therapeutic world. Most people are fourth order. And Keegan makes a great case, like you have to be at fourth order to be a sufficient therapist. You can't do it from third. But there's a lot of, you know, this is being codependent is pathological. It's like, no, you know, it might be pathological in a broader assessment, but codependence is actually it's the definition of being socialized.
Right.
Like it's the healthy adaptation for adolescents to be growing into. Yet a lot of our young, you know, adolescents who are in with therapy, they're working with somebody who's in their 30s or 40s or 50s, and they're firmly rooted in fourth order most of the time. And they're just pathologizing it.
Right.
And they internalize it. You know, it's a huge problem.
Well, this is where a more integral, if you will, psychotherapist would realize that my job here is to help this person to be healthy at the stage that they're at.
Right.
And but of course, and again, I'm going to use the tiers and the Ken's altitudes. Every first tier altitude thinks that theirs is the only right way.
Right, right, right.
And so they do pathologize. They probably pathologize or basically can't see what's next either.
Yeah.
In terms of development.
Right.
So.
Yeah, and so the leap into second tier happens somewhere on this bridge from fourth to fifth.
Yeah. So what are you seeing in your clients that sort of fleshes this out or gives us a little more sense of this, particularly this move from fourth to fifth, or self-authoring to self-transforming?
Yeah. Well, one is a suspicion. And well, let me back up, because I'll say one thing. Therapy and performance coaching, both, I do both of those things. And when somebody is working their way into the self-transforming mind, therapy takes on a dynamism and a playfulness that is novel.
Mm-hmm.
You know, fourth order has a very serious agenda, and it pervades through the whole thing. And even if I'm playful, they don't quite get it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they're very serious, and they're very kind of like, you know, I'm paying you a lot of money.
Think you're not taking them seriously, or
no, not so much.
Uh-huh.
You know, I don't get that feedback. But they won't get the playfulness of their life.
Mm-hmm.
And at fifth order, we can see immense fluctuations of like, I'm absolutely devastated by what my heart's touching, and the next moment laughing. And not like a dissociative like laugh, but I mean a rich, integrated, like their nervous system is becoming more more coherent, and they're like laughing at their condition. You know, so that's like some of the textures are this polarity, like the dialectical intelligence gets very fluid.
Mm-hmm.
in fifth order, and it's something that I'm always working to find, where are they getting congealed into their more autonomous fixed reference points, and then yoking them out of that into the more dialectical fluidity. But
now, what is dialectical intelligence, dialectical fluidity? What do you mean by that?
Yeah, yeah. So in terms of like we're talking about seriousness and playfulness, that polarity.
Mm-hmm.
And so one of the ways that we can talk about development is this, the size of the self. So prior to the third order, right? So second order of consciousness, which is the imperial stage of development.
And this is pre-socialized.
Yeah, pre-socialized. My sense of self is completely consumed by my personal preferences and agendas. And it's when Rob throws a temper tantrum and, you know, Jeff throws his temper tantrum because he didn't like the more relative things didn't go his way. And we throw our fits, but we can see it in kids. We can see it in adults if we're just honest with ourselves, but it's the temper tantrum, and the self literally is the size of themselves.
Right.
And at the third order, at the socialized mind, the self actually becomes the size of their culture. Now, at first, it might just be the family system at home. It might just be kind of the ecosystem of my friends, but it gets bigger and bigger, right? But it's socialized, and it can really stretch even to like the American or the, you know, European identity, or, you know, I'm French, you know, it can get that big. And there's some facet of when we go into fourth order, the self authoring mind, the self gets larger than culture,
mm-hmm.
which is a necessity. Mm-hmm. Like, you have to get bigger than culture.
Now, would you say that it gets large world centric or even cosmocentric, where we identify even beyond our own lifetime?
It doesn't get cosmocentric yet.
Okay.
Right. But we definitely can get bigger than culture, and we can start to participate with culture and then put it down.
Yeah.
And that's actually a conscious choice of, am I going to step into this culture and play inside of those rules or put it down? And simultaneously, like in intimate relationships, you have to have this. I mean, it's just, if it's an enduring relationship, I mean, you can, you know, do it for a short period of time, but enduring relationships, you have to be able to step out of the relationship, you know, step out of the culture of the relationship to see it and work on it while still being on the inside. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a fourth order capacity. But so we've got this ability to get bigger than culture, and the move from fourth to fifth, which you're kind of like, I love you're grinning at it, mm-hmm. but
it's exciting. I'm actually listening to you and having thrill sensations I know what you're talking about. And sometimes I wonder if I'm just like autistic, you know, I mean, I just wonder if I'm just not really getting it in the first place, that
right,
I can
right.
pick it up and let it put it down so easily.
Gotcha.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah, totally. Totally. Well, and it's a good thing, Jeff. At least I'm going to pony up and say this is a really good thing. But so the size of the self gets bigger than polarity. And that's what I mean by dialectical.
Mm-hmm.
The polarities, and this is an ongoing process, right? Because in the moment, we might actually be seeing this polarity of playfulness and seriousness. You know, we might even be seeing like our conversation in this moment right now. It's got a conceptual meatiness to it, but both of us have a body energetic. Like, at least I'm tracking, you're kind of, your nervous system's pretty integrated right now. So that's a polarity. Like, it's different. You know, when I'm sitting with a client and when they're in their head, there's no awareness of going on what's in the body, you know, or when they're in their body, there's no conceptual story making happening. And that's a pre-dialectical formulation.
Mm-hmm.
And the post kind of this post-conventional move into elegance, as I would call it, or integral consciousness, whatever we want to label it. But this shift, the self gets bigger than polarity.
Yeah, that's great. I want to emphasize that. The self gets bigger than polarity. So you can basically hold both poles at the same time.
Amen, brother.
Wow. That's something.
And which enables you to participate with one polarity really fiercely.
Yeah.
In opposition of the other.
Right.
And literally in the next moment, you can drop that opposition and be inhabiting that other polarity.
Yes. So it's not trying to find some homogenized, muddled middle.
No.
It's not putting it all in a blender.
No.
It's having access to the whole range, including the extremes at any given moment.
Right.
With fluidity.
Yeah.
Oh, fabulous.
And this quality of the blender, let me kind of find the middle.
Yeah.
That's kind of a synthesis of the two.
Yeah.
That's a fourth order move of relating to polarities, of let me manage these things.
And you see it all the time.
Yeah, you can see it. And the bandwidth of aliveness, and this is the tragedy, like the bandwidth of aliveness gets really fucking narrow.
Yeah.
I mean, it gets really constricted because they don't want to leave their comfort zone.
Mm-hmm.
Meanwhile, a self that's genuinely bigger than polarity is simultaneously like stretched and worked, and like it might be anxious and terrified, but it's also usually kind of smiling like you. Yeah. It's like, I'm terrified and I'm kind of like this,
yeah.
You know, and there's a playful quality coming back to that.
Mm-hmm.
And there's inside of like tremendous heartbreak and devastation is like bliss and the fullness yeah. of life that there's no words for.
Right.
And I'm willing to participate with these huge polarities of life and death, form and formlessness to get to cosmocentric in the yeah. true sense of the term of
ahead. I was just going to say that this is a spiritual move. Of course, it's a spiritual move all the way up in
right,
a sense,
right.
but yeah. this is where, you know, I think of, so you teach at Naropa. I went to Naropa. There's a lot of Buddhist influence in the integral world space and
yeah,
so forth.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I just think it's so consequential that this encounter of Buddhist philosophy and psychology and Western is really calls forth what you're talking about.
Yeah.
And meditation is one of these sort of engines of that.
Right.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, and going back to some percentages, so the average population, and I'm going to switch to some other tests, and this is on ego development side of the street. But really, really, really refined. So it's the highest levels of fourth order. That kind of autonomy, we only find 2-3% of the population inhabiting it, or above.
Mm-hmm.
So 97% of the general adult population doesn't get there.
Right.
To really, really refined, polished, like gorgeous integrity from mm-hmm. autonomous functioning, it's mm-hmm. not happening for right. most people. And that's just the general population. Now, Harvard graduates are the next highest kind of cluster of people that have been studied. And they come in around 10%,
mm-hmm.
reach this really fine, polished stage of autonomy or beyond.
Mm-hmm.
And which is like whatever the rigor and tradition and whatever they're doing, that's magnificent because we've taken it like 2-5 times the amount of people. You know, I mean,
right.
There's something like really profound to be said about that. But now there's management schools employing meditative techniques over a long-term period of time. And what does that result in? And the results are just staggering. It's close to 40%.
Really?
38% of the people are at this really polished stage of development or beyond. 38%. Wow. So there's something really powerful about being plunged into what some of the research literature calls post-representational experience.
Right? Wow. So so what's that mean? Just give us a quick definition. Post-representational
experience.
Okay.
Yep. Because it's not thinking. Because this thinking is the symbolic activity of the mind, and it's representing everything.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just like looking at the table. You know, like the representational part of the mind is, you know, this is a table, it's made of wood, it's got, you know, this kind of property. And I'm relating to it more symbolically, and it's different than the non-symbolic or post-symbolic experience of this table right now, which is what's the felt sense of it?
Mm-hmm.
You know, no language, but what's the actual interior, like,
direct experience.
Resonance. It's a direct experience, precisely.
Mm-hmm.
So post-representational experience is just one way of talking about, we might call it a meditative state, right. But most people, when they sit and meditate, are plunged in a whole bunch of symbolic activity.
And you're saying that there are business schools who are teaching this and working with this.
Right.
And appreciate this.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And it grows people. And it's not just that it's creating really high levels of autonomy, and post-autonomous functioning or what I would call elegance. It's not just creating more elegance, but all of the measures of the conventional stages are also increasing.
Mm-hmm.
So there is tremendous amount of empirical evidence that meditation in itself does help ongoing development. Ken's been, you know, beating this drum for many, many decades, but it continues to reveal more and more information.
Yeah.
You know, in this particular study that I'm just referencing was a 10-year longitudinal study. So it's got some weight behind it.
Yeah.
You know, it's got some.
Now, has this come out of the Harvard of Keegan and Suzanne and just people working at Harvard on this? Is this, I mean, part of why I ask is because I get discouraged, honestly, when I think of integral and how it's catching on or not catching on. And why isn't the whole world afire with integral, you know, because that's what happened to me when I was exposed to integral thinking. It was like my whole world changed.
Right.
And I also get that integral as a stage of consciousness is arising under its own power, whether or not people are aware of the word integral in any of these teachings. I mean, just sort of a flex flow kind of consciousness is arising. You see it all over the place.
Right.
But it's interesting to me, if there is, of course, Harvard is the establishment of the establishment.
Yeah.
If there is actually, you know, acceptance of this in that world.
Yeah, and I mean, I just give huge bows to Suzanne Cook-Reuter. I mean, her work has been pivotal in so many ways the past three decades. And her research brings a nuance. So Keegan's stages of development, they cap off at the fifth order. You know, and it's like, what is the sixth? Well, he didn't propose one, you know. And Cook-Reuter really brings in a more fine-tooth distinction. It's like there's actually some sub-stages in here, or there's actually some different stages beyond fifth order, and revealing that.
And what do they look like?
Well, we find the first one is the construct aware. And the construct aware is really, it's an interesting one because...
Now, this would be fifth order or self-transforming or post?
This is precisely where fifth order begins.
Okay.
Is right where Suzanne's construct aware begins.
Okay, great.
So there are two different lenses looking at the same territory. But
and this would be roughly second tier.
Yeah, and I would say we can see some second tier stuff happening before we get to fifth order and construct aware.
Okay.
Some early kind of, but certainly once you get into fifth, at least as I understand it and articulate it in the elegant self, we're talking about a really polished, mature second tier.
Cool.
And then Suzanne's unitive stage of development catapults us into, you know, beyond.
Okay, so let's talk about these.
Yeah,
so construct aware.
Yeah.
So it was just sort of this entry level.
Yeah. So one of the interesting features that we find about construct aware is it is a mixture of really high self-esteem and really low self-esteem.
Really?
Yes.
Oh, good.
Yeah. And the reason why is the self, in its more conventional sense, is becoming an object. And one of the reasons why Suzanne calls it construct aware is because you can actually see the self forming and constructing itself moment to moment. So even just like the selfing that's doing you right now, is there's this like open curiosity and like a metabolizing activity that's happening, and it's actually constructing how Jeff is experiencing himself right now. Or at least that's kind of, you know, my vote over here just sitting with you. Mm-hmm. Is it somewhere in the neighborhood?
Yeah, right on.
Yeah. So that becomes an object. So the conventional activity of selfing, of forming a self and constructing a reference point, becomes an object.
I see it, in other words.
It's an object.
It's no longer me sort of consumed or identified by it, but I actually am seeing it from a...
Spot on.
From a bigger space, you might say.
Right. There's a bigger subjectivity that's not that.
Yeah.
And at the same time, I've spent my whole life identified with that.
Yes.
So I can be seeing it as an object, and particularly the early parts of this phase, it's like I've got some distance from this activity of selfing, right? And, you know, I slip just a second, you know, somebody asks me a question, I have to do some rote activity, and I'm back in it. And it might be like 2 months before I'm like, oh,
Yes.
And
it
and,
can absolutely be 2 months. It's the, you know, fact, it's the strangest thing.
Right. And some would say, you're lucky if it's only 2 months. Yeah. Because sometimes it's 2 years, you know. But this ability to see the self brings up a lot of freedom, right? A lot of like, oh my God, you asked right at the beginning of this interview, what am I? And I'll circle back on that, but that's like one of the most elegant questions that I see happening in my clinical practice. It just happened yesterday. It was amazing. Like, what am I?
It's not even who am I?
No. What am I? And that question is like so good.
Yeah.
But we're starting to become more liberated, and not just in a transient sense. It's coming and going, but it's not the state stuff that's the state training that we've been doing, you know, however long. It's something's emerging, and it's a becoming more of a permanent feature of I'm no longer identified with my relative body mind.
Wow.
You know, I'm actually, there's some space, but the habituated activity of self, body and mind, does not stop.
Right.
And the most painful part of this stage is that sometimes it gets suspended or it falls away. It just mysteriously happens. And, you know, you're like in your backyard and you're looking at a tree, you know, or you're holding a cup and there's no words for it.
Right. Yeah.
What's exuding from you right now is like to bring some like really geeky academic lingo in here. It's one of my favorite terms from Cook Greuter. She calls this the undifferentiated phenomenological continuum, which like what?
Yeah.
But undifferentiated phenomenological continuum, like our subjectivity becomes immersed in this, the formless quality of it, like the complete emptiness of it, perhaps, as well as this infinitely rich dynamic flux of life. Of life force and form and diversity, and like the beauty is just, you know, you're drinking coffee and you're crying because or you're laughing, like those are the that's the response. So you construct aware, you bump into these experiences.
Well, what kills me about it in my own experience is I can almost do that at will, when I remember to or even want to. It's like, why don't I do that more? It's not that hard. I mean, what you're just talking about it, and I'm there. You are too. You know, it's like, why don't I do that more?
Right.
And I guess I'd ask you that question. Is it that it's not functional? That it's a place of sort of retreat from life? Or, you know, I mean, I get confused. I have a hard time wrapping my head around it. Because my head's not really... there.
Right.
Or something.
Well, I'll just say that initially there's no way to control it.
Yeah.
Like you're describing some unitive features where like on will or accessibility to this kind of openness to life in an unmediated, unfiltered way becomes much more easy. And that's another stage in itself, but a construct aware, we get these tastes of like the holy, and then it's gone.
Right.
And we're stuck in the conditioning, and we know some of the things, like I need to stop struggling with what's here. Like if I could just stop struggling with the struggle, but I'm struggling with the struggle, and I'm like, that's what they're consumed in. And so they fluctuate from like tasting the honey, and then it's gone, and they can't get it back. And so we see self-esteem just plummet.
Right.
We just see it plummet. And at the same time, these people have immensely refined skills and capacities in the world far beyond most of their peers. Right? And so what they're capable of doing in the world, they can kick ass and ask questions later and ask questions while they're kicking ass. You know what I mean? And be aware of the whole process at the same time in many ways. And so they have tremendous confidence and ability in the world in many cases, but like when it gets to the heart of what they really want in life, they haven't quite mastered it. you know, and the unit of feature starts to bring that on.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember what your question was, but
well, I'm just trying to get a feel for what's the texture, what's it like at these stages.
So initially, the plunge into this undifferentiated experience, or what I just call it like an experiential flux. We can call it an unmediated or a largely unmediated experiential flux. And initially, it's something that's more recreational, and it's more a state experience as we would tend to think about it, like this immersion into life, like, whoa, you know, and it's like everything slows down and stops and the normal activity kind of gets suspended, you know. But later on, that functioning, that ability to be naked with experience, which is another way that I talk about it, is that this naked permeable contact with the flux of form gets integrated into the rest of life, you know, where we're no longer separating the two.
Right.
You know, they become more integrated.
Right. You basically get stabilized there.
It gets stabilized.
Yeah.
And in that sense, we're starting to talk about the unit of features of Suzanne Cook-Reuter's model.
This would even be post-fift or post-self-transforming mind.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. Right.
And this is a small sliver of people who have any stable realization at that level. So just to get, you know, have the rubber meet the road a little bit, if we talk about this fifth level of self-transforming and post even, what's it like being in relationship, going to work, dealing with politics and the cable news and, what's it like?
Well, the early features of fifth are immense conflict. And usually the conflict is there's an inner battle that's going on. Because subjectivity has now a tremendous new object, most notably the conventional self to struggle with, there's plenty of interior space to entertain people for decades. And it's tremendous amount of conflict in like, I want to end my conditioning. I want to get out of this conditioning. I want to free myself from this knot, you know, and surprise, I mean, unless you pick up a really intense state training and you only commit yourself to states, right, and you only create and maintain and sustain absorptive states, it never goes away.
Right.
It never goes away. And so the freedom gets integrated into the conditioning. And this is, you know, I close.
So run that by me again. Freedom gets integrated into the conditioning. So run it by me again.
Yeah. Well, the conflict with conditioning is a defining feature.
Okay. All right. So my conditioning. So I have these habits of mind, I have these habits of behavior.
Right.
Okay. So
let me suspend them and get out of them.
Okay. So I went out. Now I realize what a prison they are and how torturous they are. And I've had tastes of freedom from them.
Yeah.
And so I want to be rid of them. So that's the conflict.
Yeah.
Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah,
okay.
Totally.
All right.
Totally.
So cool. So then keep going.
And there's a mysterious transformation, and it's a dramatic developmental shift between this tension and inner struggle and radical acceptance of what is.
Mm.
And the radical acceptance is.
I'm not there yet. That's why.
Well,
a tough one.
The vast majority of us, we're not there. You know, it's just, you know, we're not there. And are we there stably all the time? I mean, like, let's try to find somebody.
Yeah. I mean, I can, like I said, I can actually kind of conjure it up.
Right.
You know, if I'm out in the backyard, as you were saying, and I just sort of like relax and breathe in and appreciate being alive and know that it's a flash and it's all good and all is well. I can do that almost at will. But can I hold on to that? Can I stabilize that? No way. I'm back in here, you know, a screaming Mimi, you know, a minute and a half later. It's
weird. Right. Well, you know, this is the tail end of my book. The last few chapters are completely just devoted to this one inquiry of like, how do we actually go in and cultivate creme de la creme of elegance, if you will. Mm-hmm. Like, how do we actually bring more of this on and then actually bring it into relationships and work and vocation and education? And we need those agents of change and transformation to inject this culture of mind into our intimate relationships, our family systems, the organizations and governmental structures that are in place. And like, we have to re-architect a new world from elegance, right? You know, and
so how do we, like, what are some of the, if you will, techniques or practices that really help? I know meditation, clearly.
Yeah.
But and what else are you thinking?
Well, there's two of the strategies that I use is actually turning towards subjectivity, which is very simple. And it's kind of, it's a meditative technique, but it's a way of cultivating a relationship with what I call the self without form, right? So the self without form, how do we actually cultivate that? Probably the simplest and most direct way is to go, just keep turning towards the center of subjectivity, right? And that actually helps us find a stability that is unchanging.
So explain that, turning towards the center of subjectivity.
It means just Jeff turning towards the center of Jeff.
Mm-hmm.
Like
who am I?
Just that, what am I? Mm-hmm. You know, like, try to find the subject.
Yeah, fair enough.
And that subjectivity is immensely good at finding all of the objects that are arising. Right? But when you ask it to find itself, it can't do it.
Right.
And you immediately find this, like, mystery. Like, that's the basic response. It's like, it's mystery. And then on the inside of mystery, it's just completely empty. And that's a really powerful way of finding stability. Yeah. We have to cultivate that if we're going to have what I call turning towards the experiential flux of life. Right? Because if we don't have formless stability, we'll try to create stability inside the form.
Right.
And that's what creates this congealing of consciousness and identity around, you know, your particular body, mind, or your preference, or your ideology, or mm-hmm. your political philosophy, or whatever mm-hmm. it might be. And whenever we do that, we're actually collapsing the complexity of the human being. And we're taking elegance and we're just saying, I don't even want to participate with elegance. Mm-hmm. You know? Yeah. like that's really what's happening. Yeah. And so we need to find a stability that's unconditioned. We have to find some way to get in contact with the self without form.
Yeah.
And the other part is, but we can't just hang out in emptiness,
yeah.
as you know.
Yes.
Like, you know, we've done our fair amount of sitting.
Right.
Doesn't work.
Right.
We also need to get open the aperture of subjectivity towards the flux of form,
yeah.
and the nuance and the texture and the complexity that's constantly arising moment to moment.
Well, that's what I was going to ask you. Is that something you just do through the day, that you do in relationships?
So here's the trick. So I give these exercises and I describe them and kind of here's how you do it. And then there's a caveat. It's like, do these injunctions, learn them, like integrate them into your body mind's ability to execute them, right? And then stop. And this is where a lot of people get hung up. And it collapses our ability to grow into greater integral maturity or greater elegance or however we want to call it. But the I'm now going to do this. That right there is a very subtle move that congeals a subjectivity that I am now somehow prior to the immediacy of what's here.
Mm-hmm.
And mm-hmm. as soon as you do that, I mean, it's so subtle, but mm-hmm. as soon as you do that,
mm-hmm.
like the really fun territory of life is not on the menu anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Like the waiter came and took the special menu from you and you only get to order from the conventional stuff, you know?
The kids menu.
And you only
you get a hot dog or french fries.
Seriously.
Yeah.
But so it's learning the techniques. And then it's starting to get curious about how is life working me? Right? So we want to cultivate autonomy and individuality and drive and intention and will. but in the face of elegance, they're completely impotent. And I shouldn't say completely, but they're like largely, they cannot touch it. Mm-hmm. They just can't, because they're intoxicated by their own arrogance, you know, their mm-hmm. own entrenched conceitedness. Mm-hmm. And so we have to start asking, what's the injunction that my effort and will can pick up that drops my effort and will?
Right.
And so we get into this paradoxical thing, but the essence is we've got to stop trying to do things, right? And we've got to start allowing the greater flux of life to work us.
Right.
And again, having that self without form is a huge vantage point to have in order to trust form that deeply.
Right.
And as you know, these aren't separate.
Right.
You know, like
no, it's tricky.
It's tricky.
Yeah.
But part of the art of cultivating elegance is learning to actually soften and become interpenetrated by life.
Yeah.
You know, and like just well,
it's almost like a flow state.
Yeah,
right? Where,
yeah, we could talk about it like
you know, it's like I'm shushing down the mountain on my skis,
mm-hmm.
and it's like if the minute I think about doing it and the techniques that I'm using to do it, it's gone.
Yeah,
and the magic that was actually skiing me down that hill is gone.
Right.
So it's I think it's really tricky.
It's super tricky.
You know, to like. So it's like you're asking me to be enlightened, but then not be there when it happens. You know, it's like, what fun is that?
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
But anyway, yeah. It's interesting, you mm-hmm. know, but it's what happens again under its own power. I mean, we have to assume that we're growing. I mean, it's like a flower. There's a growth imperative
right.
with all of us. And we can practice that in a way that it's like fertilizing and watering and tending a flower.
Yeah.
But the growth is
right.
intrinsic mm-hmm. in the being itself.
Yeah.
And that's good to remember. Right.
Yeah. That's a useful reference point to just help you soften into the life force that's already working you.
Yeah.
You know, and already, because it's happening. It's like this one cortical, you know, it's not one, but this top-down cortical flow of this reference point of like, hey, you know, trust yourself.
Yeah.
You know, like trust life.
Yeah.
And it's this one thing, and we're like, I don't know. Meanwhile, the rest of your organism is already doing it. It's really like, are we going to get the prefrontal cortex to catch up with everything? You know, or not.
Yeah.
In some ways, you know, but certainly in terms of going to relationships and well, let's just tour some relationship dynamics, because one, conflict gets fun.
Yeah.
Conflict gets fun. It's third order, the socialized mind. Conflict is death.
Yeah.
It is to be avoided at all costs. And, you know, if we're dating, like you do something and I give you this covert thing to get you to conform to my expectations, that nasty, really, you know, fun stuff,
mm-hmm.
you know, whereas in fourth order, I'm going to really kind of like, you know, address you directly about the conflict and I'm going to, but I really care about you and let's find a win-win situation.
Right.
You know, it's classic.
Compromise or,
let's
or
compromise.
Whatever.
And
yeah.
And fifth is not at all interested in either one of those options in many ways.
Right.
It's interested in being transformed.
Right. Winning is the booby prize.
It's the booby prize. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But and Keegan, he's really elegant on this part. I mean, he says that conflict is there to solve you.
Right,
you know, and so whenever you're trying to solve the conflict, you've actually killed the precious opportunity. The conflict is because the external conflicts that we get entangled in are reflecting an interior conflict inside ourselves. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of standard. People are like, yeah. But it's the conflict isn't going to go away ever.
Right.
It's called these positions are unresolvable. They're polarities for a reason. They're dualities for a reason. And there is no resolution.
Yeah.
Now, superficially, we can kind of figure out some way, but conflict at its heart, it wants you to be bigger than polarity.
Yes.
End of story.
Yeah.
And until you actually untangle yourself from some conscious or unconscious collapse around one polarity and it in conflict with this other thing over there, until you unravel that knot and become transformed, you're going to be entrenched in this conflict
right. Indefinitely. Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And we realize, even looking evolutionarily, that conflict is one of the great engines of evolution all the way up.
From the
beetles in the field to the animals in the jungle.
Yeah.
And it's not about resolving it. There's a growth that comes from the contention itself.
Yeah.
And so conflict is fun. That's a marker of what you're talking about with this fifth plus order of consciousness. I love that.
Yeah.
And actually, I'd also say that's true even in terms of politics
and
the cable news. And,
totally.
You know, it's not to say that you don't get passionately involved and you take a stand and you vote and you work and all of that stuff.
Right.
But there's a lightheartedness about it.
There's a playfulness about it.
There's a playfulness about it. Yeah.
Yeah. Play is like...
Because you know that it's all a play anyway.
Right.
And
it's
all working itself out,
mm-hmm.
and that's relieves you of the responsibility and the guilt of having it happen in the first place and having to solve it.
Right.
That's so good.
Yeah.
So conflict is fun. Is there any other?
Well, you know, just on the conflict side, so in Construct Aware, we find that people are much more tolerant of ambiguity. Right. And conflict has that, like, where is this going to go? But so ambiguity is another kind of core feature that's been studied. And it's really interesting, like in Construct Aware, we're much more tolerant and much more willing to hang out in immense uncertainty. And at Unitive, we start to see the smiles, the kind of smiles that you've got going on, because all of a sudden we might be in a work setting and the organization's kind of like this. And it looks like just somebody went bat crazy at first glance, right? But this person is now inhabiting precisely what the organization is avoiding.
Mm-hmm.
And it's chaos. But are they being reactive? Are they being like, you know, all caught in their own imperial demands? No. Like, they're actually in an entirely different world. But they're bringing in, they're inviting things that are going to be inherently conflictual, inherently bring up a truckload of anxiety, and everybody's freaking out that aren't at that stage of development. And yet somehow they're doing it to grow the organization, you know? And it's kind of like some coyote medicine, if you will.
I was
going to
say the crazy wisdom.
Yeah, it's the crazy wisdom.
Yeah.
Certainly, like, Trungpa had some of that.
Yeah.
But that's, you know, another feature, and leadership is another conversation that's just like so fascinating. Self-authoring leadership is so boring.
Right.
And it is so inefficient.
Right.
And in the face of fifth order leadership, you know, it's a monumental leap. Let's just say there's seven people in an organization. Let's just talk a really tiny organization. One person leveraging six other human beings for their personal agenda, no matter how integrative it is a devastating loss of resources.
I feel it's suffocating me to even think about it.
Yeah. I mean, we walk in and it's like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Like, do you have any idea what just one of those beings actually plugged in with their life force is capable of doing?
Right.
So, and that's kind of what the fifth order orientation in leadership and in working in organizations is. They're suspicious of their own private agendas. They'll put them out and they'll ask everybody else to put them out, but they're not buying into any single one of them.
Right.
They're looking and they're listening for like a novel emergence that doesn't belong to anybody, but actually owns everything.
Yes.
You know,
you hear this about people who work with Barack Obama.
Yeah. He's got a lot of features.
Yeah, he's got a lot of those features.
Yeah. But it's totally confusing for the other stages, you know, third order and fourth order. They don't know how to make of it oftentimes.
Yeah. Wow.
Anyway.
How exciting. Well, we've gone quite a while here. And yeah. I actually want to ask you one last question. And
give it to
me. That is one of the great cliches of teaching, that one of the best ways of learning something is to teach it.
Yeah.
And you wrote, that's an amazing book. I mean, I've just been enjoying the hell out of it and appreciating it paragraph by paragraph.
Thanks.
And so, you know, how's that changed you? What's the new Rob like?
That's a good question. That book was written in about 8 weeks.
Are you serious?
And most of it in 4.
Wow.
And I would say that it wrote me more than I wrote it.
Nice.
I mean, it definitely took me saying yes and participating, but it was, it reshaped me dramatically, you know, and yeah, there's still the enduring qualities and predisposition and so on and so forth. But I had some felt sense in my body of what needed to come out, but I had no clue, mm-hmm. no clue. And my understanding of fifth order consciousness has been reshaped, right. And even the depth of my understanding of how human beings, I mean, it's pretty significant in terms of
yeah.
the whatever came through me last summer when I wrote it. It just, it changed me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I can testify here and now that you're transmitting it.
You yeah.
know? I mean, I feel definitely a blast of what you're talking about in your presence.
Yeah.
And that's really delicious, Rob.
Thanks.
And thank you for putting it down.
Yeah.
And delivering it in such an elegant package.
Thank you. Yeah.
Again, Rob McNamara, the book is The Elegant Self. And thank you so much, Rob, for being with us.
Love you, brother.
Love you too, man.